Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cass again, your mild-mannered reporter, columnist from the Chicago Tribune, and Jeff Carlin, WGN AM producer, Rokon Show with Anna. What's up, Jeff?
Hey, John.
I hope you did not have a happy Memorial Day, because there's nothing happy about Memorial Day. It's about memory of the dead who died for us, so that we can look at this republic and see what? The President of the United States coming back to two cultures, the pro-impeachment media, negative Trump culture that demands his head on a pike, and the 60 million people who don't Twitter or don't worry themselves about social media, who voted for him so he would basically kick the Washington establishment in the private parts. How's that going to be resolved, Jeff Carlin?
Who knows?
We also have the shrinking city.
Yeah.
The amazing shrinking city. You've heard about it. The city keeps shrinking, and the politics of it are thus. The bosses of the Democratic Party have always said, shut the bleep up.
Population keeps shrinking, but our debts keep growing. Oh, how fun
is
that?
Isn't that nice?
And guess who picks up the tab?
Right. So I feel like we're in a musical chairs situation. People are saying, why don't you come to Houston? I said, the Tribune's here. I eat here. Manja in Chicago, okay? Also, later in our podcast, we're going to have Elizabeth Taylor,
Liz podcast. Taylor, yeah. My mom wears her perfume.
Yes. She is the literary editor at large for the Chicago Tribune.
Oh, that Taylor.
And she's also going to talk to us about the Lit Fest, of which I will be there, and so will Jeff, apparently. Right, Jeff?
You bet.
At 10 o'clock on Saturday, June 10th, at the Jones Commercial High School, where they're holding it indoor. Jones College Prep, so that you don't get hot. We have air conditioning, and there won't be any rain.
No one will be turned away, no matter what you see or read online.
That's right. That's what we heard.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our little birds tell us. But first, Jeff, before we get into that, what's on your mind, my friend?
What's on my mind? Actually, you know, this is the first week where weeks that have passed, I kind of go into a new week where I don't feel stressed about the news cycle, although I know this week is going to be nuts just because it is the president coming back from a trip. But last week he was abroad, and the availabilities and his presence in media was kind of limited, so the news cycle was a little slower than normal.
Well, let's put it this way. He pulled NATO together and said what he said.
Knocked their heads together.
He said what he told us he'd tell them. You owe us money. You're right. Not paying your share.
2%.
Oh, my God. That's not really part of the narrative that we want to hear. That's sort of like strong president narrative, and that must have freaked out CNN.
It was. It was interesting because you saw him. You know, you saw him land in Saudi Arabia, and it was
That was another astounding
thing. Yeah, it was amazing on its own right. But then you saw him as more. I say presidential, and I only mean historically speaking, like the presidential that the leader thing. But no. But the point that you made earlier that he was elected to come in and kick ass and take names, and that was his thing, and not be a president.
But what did he do in Saudi Arabia? He told the Arab world, we'll work with you, but terrorism is your deal.
Right.
You have to – I can't – that is so different from what mm-hmm. The passive aggressive triple biographer in chief would have done.
Baby Bush. I mean, he was right. He was more about going after them, and regardless of what they thought.
But, yeah, we're gonna. But my we'll point kill was, you yeah. whether you like it or not.
But
yeah.
My point is that there was this kind of transition. I mean, he didn't stray away from his his personal edict to be this president who was shaking things up, but he was much more. Maybe he was just tired and
commanding.
He was just getting. He was much more. I think. Passive in his openness to experience everything. He didn't seem like he was trying to be the center of attention in Saudi Arabia.
Although I think some of the press tried to make a big deal about whether he touched somebody's hand.
Who cares? That stuff's...
But he did hold a sword in his hand, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
And then in Israel, too, the kind of similar thing. He was trying to be the guy who's like, hey, look, I'm here to try to help. How can I help kind of thing?
Right.
And then as he moved, further into Europe, he became more the, the presidential Trump, I'm leading the way, doing it my way. And my way is America is a leader of the world. And this is what we think is important. And if you don't get in line and you don't listen to us and you don't try to support this cause because it's best for everybody – you're going to get left in the dust.
Of course, what happened is the terrible, horrific assassination, terrorist attack on children in Manchester, England. And that sort of brought everything back.
Right.
Like, okay, here's a guy who is not afraid to say Islamic terrorism to the kings and leaders of the Islamic world.
Right.
It wasn't that he was just telling it. Snowflake on CNN who would start crying, or ABC. He actually said it to them, and they responded positively. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be very interesting. But coming back to the United States, we got the impeachment drums pounding again. This will never end, but here's the question for you. It looks to me, like I said in the opening, that we're in two cultures, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the culture of media, the blue media culture, which is 80-20 negative against Trump, according to the Harvard study,
right.
Even though I know that there are leftist media critics who hate that idea. And there's another culture, the red state culture. Do you see these things? Do you see these two? How do these two cultures respond to the next phase of Trump's? Of the get Trump or impeach Trump movement.
Here's what I see happening, and this is my take and theory on what I've seen develop, that some point in the probably near future, somebody within the Trump campaign is going to fall on their sword for this whole thing, because it's seeming more and more that there was some sort of interference with the Russians, and they may have given information, they may have offered some sort of assistance to the Trump personnel without understanding what they were doing.
You mean kind of like when Obama leaned over to Medved and said,
absolutely.
Hey, after the election, tell Vladimir after the election we'll have more freedom.
Right, exactly. Right? And I think they were unwittingly, used got some sort of benefit from some sort of tool of the Russian government.
Paul Manafort.
Yeah, some of these guys. So they're going to run into this, and one of these guys is going to fall for it. And that's my take in the distant near future. So
my take is that the United States has never had two cultures which are more far apart than the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
You
nailed it last week. It's kind of a pre-revolutionary state we're in right now.
I don't know. There's what I see out there, there are people who can't give Trump an inch, and they won't give the people who supported him an inch, and vice versa. And we are almost like, I mean, there's less in common between these sides than there were between Americans in 1859. And that's something we all got to think about.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think you nailed on the head there. We're kind of in almost a pre-revolutionary or pre-civil, civil war society here, because you see it. And I just was watching a Frontline expose on Patriots. It's called Patriots. And it was about the farmers out west who are rebelling against the government because they're supposedly taking their land that they've used for generations, back all the way back to like 1805. And these groups are building militias, and they're collecting and they're congregating on the internet to bring themselves together in mass across the country. We're talking hundreds of thousands of people who are in these groups,
and it's been characterized by public broadcasting, which is funded by the government.
Right, but
interesting.
But I mean, they're Frontline. I mean, that's a knock on Frontline, but they're very down the middle. I mean, there's.
I'd say so.
I know so. I mean, I watch it religiously because it's one of the few places where you do get, you know, you get both sides of things. You get them. There's no parlance for what they're trying to bring you. It's what is this is what it is. Make your own, you know, take on it. They did a great expose on Trump and Hillary leading into the election, and it was, you know, they ripped Hillary heavily. They were into Trump's childhood. I mean, they did a really good job of presenting the facts as they were.
So how – what is the outcome if we both agree, and readers and listeners of this podcast agree, or at least some do, that we are of two separate cultures, the media blue culture and the red state culture? Why did the cultural elites, the managers of the culture of the, I'm not talking about, you know, whoever the editor of Vanity Fair is putting Chelsea Clinton up there on the cover every, or Carrie Fisher, because those people are ridiculous. But the managers of the country, how did they let this happen? And what is the outcome?
I think it's a problem that comes from the growth of the internet, because the internet, while it has allowed people across every ethnicity and social stratosphere to access information, that's great. But it's also increased and doubled the size of the echo chamber for each side, both left and right. And you have left that echoes on itself over and over and over, and that echo has become more front and center than the actual truth or the actual facts of matters, and been more important. The echo is more important than the story. And the same has happened on the right, but on a smaller scale, because they're the media outlets and the outlets that they're to produce, although they're growing steadily, and they just don't have the coverage. But the people who search, who shun the left and move to the right, they're just as ingrained and they're just as involved and subject to this echo chamber that feeds a dichotomy in our country, and it makes people more and more separated in mentality, when in reality we're not. I mean, you know, Americans, if you got them in a room from both sides, would agree on a lot more than they disagree about, because we're Americans and because we all come from, you know, a lot of us come from the same society.
One of the problems I find is that the media, and I've only been in it for 7,000 years now, the media now is driven by clicks on the internet. And these echo chambers you're talking about reinforce those clicks. They're kind of like basking in the waters of lures for writers. So if I write something with a particularly – okay, I have a partisan view. I am a conservative, a libertarian kind of slash whatever, right? But if I found that some of my other colleagues, if you go so far over, like complete – Trump sucks. Trump sucks. He sucks, sucks, sucks. Whatever, if you say something like that, obviously they write it better than that.
Sure.
You will get more clicks. So the implicit positive or operant conditioning of all this, is if we're dogs waiting for the meat powder, is to drive that bell, right? So we, therefore, what? You want more clicks, so therefore you'll become more partisan? And then it becomes more, so that doesn't speak to what you're talking about, which is we're really a lot of, there's much common ground. And so then we get even, the culture drives even farther apart. And it's terrifying because I see people perpetuating it in order for their own selfish purposes on the left or the right.
We talked to Tom Bevin last week, and
I was so glad we had
it. Yeah, and he made a great point, and not even a great point, but he made it, brought to our attention the conversation he had with Condoleezza Rice, who is a brilliant human being. I mean, there's no question there. You can't slant that one way or another. She's a brilliant human being. She made the point that, you know, our society really needs a common goal. That we haven't had in, you know, a couple generations, maybe two generations, really. I mean, my generation and then the generations a little bit older than me, which is probably my brother's age. But you've got these people who...
What was your common goal?
Let's say we don't have that.
What was it?
Well, we had common goal in my parents' generation was, you know, anti-communist, you know, American pro-American anti-communist. I mean, that was kind of an underlying theme for a long time.
And I grew up in the duck and cover, after the duck and cover generation.
Right.
We would cover our heads so that we wouldn't get
die. Yeah, and in my brother's generation, my brother's is about 8 years older than I am, and we kind of straddled two different. You know, he was born in the 70s, I was born in the 80s, and mm-hmm. so there's a difference there, because you had the internet, you had personal media kind of became a huge thing, and so it was no longer about the common good, it was about the individual good. And the individual, whatever the individual was interested or thought or felt, was more important or was the most important thing. And so we had this generation of individuals who were shooting off from the central core of being an American or being, you know, somebody, you know, a Western civilized human being.
And also they were attacks. The idea of the West mm-hmm. has been under attack by the left, which is, it is spread in the media, the academic world, much of the corporate world, which is now tied directly to government or government leverage, and government itself, so that you had Shakespeare, for example, portraits of Shakespeare taken down from English department walls. You had the idea of Western man as old, reduced to dead white European males. Mm-hmm. That was the characterization. There, you had immigration policies which limited immigration from Europe and promoted immigration from elsewhere. You had all sorts of attacks on the West, and then you have people, some of whom don't really understand what it is to be a liberal, which is what I thought we were all supposed to be, but now that definition has changed to be something of the left, but we have to distinguish between liberals and the hard left.
Or even really, I mean, not even liberal, progressive, because humanity is progressing, and people who are progressive are embracing.
Yeah, but progressive is kind of like,
but I'm saying that's
pro-choice rather than.
But that's been bastardized into that position. Yeah. We were all progressives, and liberals were more of that.
Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive.
Right. But progressive in the nature that, you know, society, civilization marches on.
Evolving.
Right.
But I don't evolve, well, Jeff. I don't want to evolve. I want, as a conservative, I hold to traditional values, to traditional understandings. I am not my own God. I know I have a Twitter account, but I am not my own God. God is God. Yeah, perhaps that's because of my Orthodox upbringing. I think that Western man, that the West is the place where people are truly free, where we ask questions, and philosophers ask questions about who am I, where am I going, why am I here, and all that is under attack by a combination of forces where the left wants to obliterate Western man. Man, can't even say man in college papers now. Mankind,
right.
You have to say humankind. Or instead of before Christ, you have to say before the common era.
Right.
These Orwellian twists mm-hmm. are what I fight against.
And I think some of it, John, is a realization that the sins of Western civilization for a long time were tamped down by those in charge of Western civilization, because the pillaging of Africa in the colonial area and even South America. I mean, you know,
yes,
so
there
all
are terrible
those,
things happen.
Right, and so all those things were then, you know, in a modern era where information becomes easier to spread, that people are becoming aware of these things, and then they're using that to say that all of Western civilization is bad because it did X, Y, and Z to get to where it is. But that's the core of humanity. Humans take advantage of other humans to benefit themselves. That's always been how it is. And to do that and to say, well, you know, Western civilization did a lot of bad things for the world, and it's done a lot of bad things in its own right, but and we should attack it for it, it doesn't make any sense, because Western civilization has done so much more good for the world in the essence of freedom and non-repressive thought and moving as a progressive nature. But they're using that exactly. idea that, hey, you know, did these horrible things. How dare you be at the top of the hill? You shouldn't
be. A culture that would bring indigenous tribes to a pyramid and cut off their heads is not a, you know, and human sacrifice is not generally what I think is an ideal culture, but that's just me. Mm-hmm. The Spanish conquistadors, who I think were amazing people, can't be taught. Be, you know, 180 people, 180 men conquering a continent. I'm sorry. I think that's pretty remarkable. But we have to denigrate them. Okay, I get it. I understand the politics of that. At the same time, have you ever been to Pennsylvania?
I
have. To a place called Gettysburg?
I have not.
Since we've just passed Memorial Day, I remind everyone that for all this talk about white man's privilege and Western man and how terrible it was, how terrible we all must be, because I have to check my privilege, even though my people were fighting for their freedom against the superpower Ottoman Turks back then, is Gettysburg, where you could hear, you walk on Gettysburg and you think of the thousands upon thousands of men who died, and they died in the Civil War. And the Northerners died to free, in part, not all of it, in part, let's be honest, intellectually, mm-hmm. to free the slaves. And they bled on that ground while hordes of feral pigs would eat the bodies of the dying as they screamed at night. And whenever I think of that and then hear this sort of reflexive, check your privilege, you know what I mean? Kind of an attack, a social media attack, I get sad. It makes me sad because I think that really what it is what you said. It's about power. It's really about ignoring what happened and the nuances about what happened and just using the bold-faced type for power.
We got this message. Put down your phones. Summer's here, school's out. We've got to let you go. All through our city, get in the zone. Better see you reading when you're on your own. Get a good book and don't knock it. The story in the heat, in those pages, everybody just don't stop. Ooh, you can't take your eyes off of it. Reading recreationally, call a friend who wants to read it. And just swap on summer nights when stars start to glow. Ice cream and rocks in a book, there you go. When you read while your strategies grow. So just imagine.
Every year in June, the Chicago Tribune puts on probably the most important cultural event in the universe. And I'm part of it. And it's called the, what do we call it now?
Well, it was called the Book Fair.
Right.
But now it's called Printers Row Lit Fest.
Printers Row Lit Fest. And the woman who just corrected me, thank you, is Elizabeth Taylor, literary editor at large for the Chicago Tribune. Yeah. And she's also involved in this literary fest because if you know Elizabeth, she is kind of a culture vulture, you would have to say. She knows all the authors. She knows their backstories. Jeff Carlin and I were chatting with her just a few minutes mm-hmm. ago about all the good gossip around writers because they're all so dramatic. Not me. I'm not a real writer, but I mean the real
they're
writers.
They're inside their heads usually.
Yes. They live inside their heads. So tell us first, I'm going to be at the Lit Fest on Saturday, June 10th, when it opens for an event. And there are many people who are coming to see me and so many other people there.
You and Al Franken are very popular.
Yeah, right. Because I'm special.
Well, John, you are actually opening the book festival
mm-hmm.
At 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning. You know, we have to get our big hitters. It's right at the, it's will be in Jones High School.
Where is that?
That is on like it with near Printers Row on the
it's around
state.
700
yeah,
south.
Exactly. It's south of Congress.
Or by Columbia College, John.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Where I went to school and met a beautiful woman who was
me too.
My wife, and you met a beautiful woman there too.
Well, I don't. Right. Well, you know, one year actually we did have a couple people who have come to the festival every year, and they got married at the festival. They met there, and they had their wedding performed at the festival.
That is so. Was it Madrigal singers or? Did they have any medieval egg dancing for entertainment? Because that's a kind of, right? It sounded like a Renaissance fair people.
What do you serve at a medieval egg dancing festival?
Right. Eggs.
Oh, huh. Weird.
And smoked fish, and we drink and know things. One thing about the Lit Fest this year is in the prior years when I've done it, it's been extremely warm, sometimes hot. Sometimes when it was outdoors, it was sometimes people were overwhelmed, and I thought it was because of my brain, but really it was because of the heat. And 1 year we had to cancel because of a downpour. This year it's all inside, I presume, air-conditioned comfort. And
yes, it's, you know, what every CPS kid at Jones High School gets. Mm-hmm. Yes, will be in Jones High School. And yeah, we won't have to worry about, you know, losing electricity and all those issues involved with the vagaries of Chicago weather.
Because you know writers, Liz, they're so shy that if they don't have the proper microphones and so forth, they can't. They speak like little, right? Don't they kind of little tiny voices?
No, writer, no. Oh, no, we have so much fun with the writers. I mean, some of these events really go crazy.
Who's coming?
Okay, so who's coming? So, and it is, we try to have, I mean, I figure if I'm not having fun putting this together, then there's just no point in doing it. But so, okay, so just a small example. So there is this big, one of the first books, biographies of Hemingway. It's by Mary Dearborn. So I'm like, okay, how can we really make this fun pop? So, coming to Chicago, Goodman Theater, Pamplona, the play.
Which is, Pamplona is the play
about,
on Death of, in the Afternoon. Is it on Death in the Afternoon?
No, it's sort of the bullfighting part. And it's
of the rewritten. Of the Sun Also Rises part.
Yeah, I don't even know. I think it's his life. It's,
yes.
You know, life story. So we're having, the author and the person who's playing.
Stacey Keach.
Yes, right? Keach is going to be coming. And so it will be really fun. And Stacey Keach works with Bill Curtis on projects. So Bill Curtis is moderating.
And a perfect modular voice too.
Exactly.
I am Bill Curtis and talking to
this Hemingway. This is news tonight.
Yeah, that sounds great. I can't,
So it's all, I like to just try to have fun with, finding people moderators. I mean, you, of course, will just have, your
big
500 people, talking at you. But, just adding some dynamism to the program.
I did have some of my more left-wing readers calling to say, if they show up, will I do some sort of figure four leg lock on them? But I promise them no. I'm a physical coward. Now, what of some of the other events and people that are coming?
There's some interesting pairings, and I just loved. Obviously, we're having big Tribune events. There's going to be a big event for the Cubs, and talking about how the Page One story was put together. And Jason Wobgams will be here and talking
Pulitzer
about the Pulitzer Prize winner. And I would like to say I believe in sort of buying stock, early. And so, way back when we started inviting people in February or something, we invited two authors who later went on to win Pulitzer Prize winning books, which is Heather Ann Thompson. She wrote this amazing book about Attica and the prison uprising. And that is a fantastic book. And it, history. She won in history, and then this amazing poet, Tiamba Jess, he won in poetry.
Right.
So
right.
The idea was like, you know, trying to get them before they pop.
And, well, you know this because you have spent, Elizabeth Taylor, have spent a lifetime in books and in literature and in the publishing industry, and you know all the ins, you know, so, and people should know this, Elizabeth Taylor is the author, since we're talking about definitive biographies, of a co-author of one of the great political biographies in this country. And that is American Pharaoh, Richard J. Daley.
Right.
And you wrote that with?
My best friend, Adam Cohen, and, you know, who was at the festival last year, and he wrote this amazing book that called Imbeciles.
Is that,
I give that away.
Trumbalones?
Trumbalones of Chicago?
Yeah. It's about the Bell case. Anyway, so we are sort of partners in crime, and we, you know,
that was really a fantastic book. No. I'd say I recommend it most highly to anyone who wants to understand politics. Also, read my column if you do. You didn't put the rock in Daley's fist, did you?
We did not for the
start of the 1919 race
riot. Because actually we, you know, believe in if we don't have the full evidence, it's
right.
Just
you can't
literally.
Do it.
And we really.
This is the Chicago Tribune, not the New York Times, for God's sake. Anyway.
Whatever do you mean?
Yeah, right.
So what I will, you'll love, when I was in graduate school in history, there's an amazing historian, his name is C. Van Woodrow. And he wrote The Strange Career of Jim Crow. He's fantastic. And nobody was really talking to him. He had retired, but I would just go during graduate school and just go up and have a drink with him. And, you know,
it's all good books start.
Right. But also nobody would, they were all ignoring him. And I said to him, Professor Woodward, what do you think would be the best subject for a biography? He said, well, you have to pitch, in this great Southern accent, you have to pitch someone, a bitch or a bastard, and make sure they're dead. Which I think does sort of say it all. It's a complex person with the full measure of a life. I really don't think it's a biography the person is still alive.
And some people, I know we have some in America who write autobiographies. I think I know one who, and I know him. He's written, I think, two or three autobiographies of his life, and he's not even 60 yet. But that's okay. He's.
Did he once live in a big house in D.C.?
Yes, it was a White House.
Okay.
Also, now, let's talk about what other. Now, I think Mary Schmeek, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, my colleague, is going to be there as well.
Yes, she and Eric Zorn are going to be doing a, similar to you, a sort of opening the festival on Sunday.
Are they going to sing or
well,
anything?
You know, we've not
advertised. Mary's a good singer, actually. I remember
she is, and Eric's a musician.
Yeah,
and they
right.
do that whole thing. The songs of good cheer.
Yeah,
but this is the summer version. So, and she's also going to be talking to interviewing Jason about
Pulitzer.
The Pulitzer Prize.
And also, I think you're following me at 11 o'clock at the Lit Fest, I think, is Barbara Mahaney and Blair Kamen.
Yes.
And Barbara, another great Tribune writer who's written this fantastic book on motherhood.
Exactly. I mean, this is like the fun of, like, I'm like, I call her Bam.
Yeah.
Bam, Barbara Ann Mahaney.
Love her. Who doesn't love her?
Yeah. I mean, okay, we don't want to just, you know, put you on a panel where you talk about motherhood and, you know, and there's, but like, what would be the interesting? So I racked my brain and I was like, Bam, what about Blair?
She's
like,
Her husband,
Blair.
Pulitzer
Prize
winning
architecture. And, you know, I have known Blair since college.
Really?
Actually, so I've known the full arc of their romance. And so they agreed to, you know, they really are very, sort of very good about not promoting one another, and they don't write about each other. And So they're going to be in conversation.
That's great, because I know I can't wait to see them. And if anybody wants to stay over after I'm done, we'll go outside or something and I can have some fresh air and talk.
last year, that was the highlight. Well, not the highlight, but a highlight of John is that after he finished speaking, he wandered outside to get some fresh air, as he calls it. And there was a crowd of 25, 30 people who just stayed for probably 45 minutes just to talk to John. And
it was good. And you.
And take pictures.
And there'll be, you can,
and Betty will be there.
And you can hang out in the, everything to meet, to hang out with Betty, really. And you can also hang out in the lobby of the high school.
Sure.
We're trying
cooler.
To make this an, kind of an inviting experience, not like an institutional high school kind of thing.
What about what are some of the other great authors that will be there that we want to talk about, that we want people to know? Because, look, life isn't only Chicago Fire games and hot dogs, okay? And politics.
Well, we have some like really like fun. Well, we have some like headlining authors like Michael Eric Dyson is coming, but we also have like on the other end of the spectrum, Meta Garcia, who was the first wife of Prince. You know, so we try to go high, you know, low, and we have, as I mentioned, the Henry David Thoreau biography.
Yes,
we have two big people are Senator Al Franken and also Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Well, I would say that of the two, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is an intellect. tries to write like one. Now,
it's a really cool book. Kareem's. I went to hear him speak in L.A. and I just really hope we can bring out the crowds for him.
Is Richard Roper involved in that? He mentioned something that he and Kareem are good friends.
Yes, and so you know I'm all about like trying to get people who are in conversation that will elicit you know a great conversation where people will feel comfortable, and so Abdul-Jabbar has written this amazing book. It's not about him really. It's about Coach Wooden. And it's just like me and Mike and Coach. And it's such a great program. I mean, people say, well, we have to promote it with
like
basketball fans. And I'm like, no, we have to promote it with, you know, the Positive Sporting Coaching Alliance. We have to, you know, to kids. It's a really moving
there
book.
Are many things in, you know, you see that wizened old man. And this young African-American physical god when they were together. And you at UCLA, and you'd think, oh, nothing in common, right? Because old school, Mr. Wooden, they've named a road after him in Indiana. I drive past it when I, you know, go to IU to visit my son. But if you read Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and understand his conversion to Islam and his almost conservative, I don't mean it like a Fox News conservative way, but in his worldview, it's very, very interesting. I can't wait.
He's
that
a
would
real
be a
original.
Very good,
he's, yeah.
and good I think, conversation.
And I think, you know, and we want to make sure he's comfortable. I think that, and because, you know, he doesn't, public speaking is not really his thing.
Oh, he's good, though.
But he's really good. But he wanted Richard Roper, and so we said, absolutely.
Is he going to do the show, too?
He's
going to get him to do, you know, Jeff is the producer of the Rokan and then the
I don't know.
Yeah, I think he is. We're talking to him, so okay. Stay tuned this week.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, so we have some great characters coming, and, you know, and also with some really interesting pairings, like this wonderful woman, a poet, Elise Passion, mm-hmm. whose mother is the famed Maria Tallchief, the ballerina.
Right, the ballerina, right.
Yeah, and so Elise is a fantastic poet. I'm like, so we got together, we were hanging out with Elise. How can we make poetry more, like bring people more to your program? What can we do? And we just went through a whole list of people, brainstorming over coffee,
right.
Like 3 hours. Finally, she's like, well, you know, I'm actually headed to see to something with Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl. And it's like,
wow, that's kind of counterintuitive, but
yeah, And Gillian Flynn is so great. She is going to do that.
Really?
Yes.
I love that book.
Yes. So, but and how great. And I think Gillian is, you know, a really brilliant person, mm-hmm. I think. I think people think of her as a mystery thriller, you know, person.
No.
But she's so brilliant on the hollowed out American economy. She is brilliant. And so for her to interview a poet, how exciting.
One of the things about when I was a boy, and that means probably since I'm American, that probably means 30. I would walk around. I would, when I wanted to become a writer rather than actually write, there's this period where you kind of see yourself doing something and put on the accoutrements of what you think you should be doing. So I would have the Times Literary Supplement, and I would read the best short stories of the year and so forth. I found Raymond Carver and so forth. What is that process about when a young person decides to become to take that step into the literary life?
Well, you know, it's so personal. I mean, I think, you know, your story is very moving, that you sort of actively did that in pursuit. And I think that's important. And I think a lot of people say, well, I want to be published, which I always have a problem with. No, the problem is you should want to be a writer. Yeah. I mean, I don't remember.
Give the lady what she wants, sir. Right.
I don't remember not wanting to write. I mean, I just, as soon as I could read, I was writing,
right.
And in different forms. And I think people should learn to read and write simultaneously. I mean, everyone should be able to be
everyone
better writers.
Everyone can be writers now. Here's the, everyone is published now because in 140 characters of a blurting sentiment, sometimes with pictures, and usually sometimes with your face, with what do they call that, nom de plume, where you're actually a cartoon head of a cat, or no offense to cat lovers, or something. You say whatever you want on
Avatar.
Twitter.
I mean,
Avatar, right?
Right? I mean, yeah.
And so how does social media, where I get on Facebook and I just blast out stuff in sort of a stream of consciousness that, I mean, does that, what does that do for writing, for the writing you're talking about and I'm talking about?
Well, I mean, one of the issues is we're really talking about publishing, and that we're in a world where the focus is all it's on the bestseller list. But I see, and there's so many truly excellent books that are falling aside because nobody knows about them. So that's what I'm more worried about than these people who are just, you know, writers,
right,
and,
right.
You know, and they, you know, put itself in whatever zines or self-publish or whatever. They'll right. do their own thing. But I'm wondering about, you know, people who really, really do good work, but, you know, without a so-called platform, they can't reach an audience. So one of the things I like have a sort of like a moral purpose is about sort of trying to find those writers and, you know, like, and bring them together in a conversation. I mean, there's so many who are coming to the festival. Well, you know, like, I mean, like this woman, you know, who Bethany Ball, a fantastic novel, sort of a debut novel. And it's like, it's funny. It's called All About the Solomons. And it's the gossip on a kibbutz that really spreads through a world. So it's really, it's so many different issues. And she grew up in Detroit, but she's lived around the world. And so she's coming in. I mean, there's just so many, every author has like a really interesting story. So trying to pair them is just, you know, so much fun.
You're, if I were running the fest, I mean, the marketing of it, I would put this phrase out. open your mind. Because going to the Literary Fest to me is like going to a great bookstore where you don't, just because you've had a drink, it's in the afternoon, you're not working that day, and you've had a November day, a nice brandy, and then you walk into a bookstore and you can still taste the coffee in your mouth, and you don't have any plan. And you walk in and you just browse through a library, through a bookstore. You see things. Your mind opens because you didn't know that you didn't know that William Carlos Baker wrote the first definitive biography of Hemingway. And then this new one is out. Right. You just open your mind this way. It's like what is that thing around the yolks? The egg.
Yeah.
It's like egg cracking when you walk in.
And there is eggs, multiple eggs. And
right.
So, I mean, one thing we didn't talk about was we will, even though things will be inside, we will have the vendors outside.
Wonderful.
Which is, these people have been coming to the festival for years. And, the amazing finds of, some people that, the first editions of this. Well, no, just a book that you'd heard about and, just looks interesting. And so the browsing is still a possibility. And I sincerely, deeply hope that what people will say, your fans will say, hey, I'm going to, I want to hear John Cass, but I'm going to stick around and I'm going to cruise through, these classrooms. And like, there's these three authors sitting around talking. Well, hey, I'll just pop in there
They've spent their lives walking on many. I'm not talking about the self-marketers and the people that write books to sell and the sort of, and they have
people running for government writing books.
Or what? There's a certain type of person that's a marketer writer, and they have their blogs and so forth.
Right.
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the people you find. By themselves, they walk on a high wire, and they are like the Walendas of the world. And you might walk into one of these rooms and see someone who spent their life walking that high wire, and you don't know why. And you sit down and you hear them.
And 99% of these people have day jobs. I mean, it's impossible in the old days, being a writer and supporting yourself, but most of these people have other jobs.
Not everybody can do watercolors with rabbits and have rich parents. Elizabeth Taylor, where could people find more out about the Lit Fest that begins Saturday, June 10th and Sunday, June 11th?
Yes, at PrintersRowLitFest.com.
Just Google it?
Yeah, Google it.
And you'll find
me. I love hearing from people. I mean, I'm no John Cass, but
please.
People call me all the time and say, what do you recommend I go to? And I will personally recommend programs that I
that would be awesome to get your to get the personal Elizabeth Taylor recommendations. You should email her.
Yes, here's my Elizabeth.Taylor. email@gmail.com.
Okay, good.
Right.
And you will have decades of wisdom. Person that goes out and finds these wonderful writers that you can meet them, you can talk to them, you can ask them questions, and I hope to see you there. And it'll just be great. And again, there's nothing a writer likes more than actual conversations with people who've actually read their work.
Exactly.
Because they want to answer the question perhaps that they missed, because no writer's satisfied with what they've done. Elizabeth Taylor?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. It was a blast.
You are so cool. Thank you.
No, thank you. All right.
Now here is a question for you. Remember, the answer will start with a Q. Just think of a duck, be it white, brown, or black. What sound does it make? Why a ducky goes?
No, one of the things we like to do here on the Chicago Way is to take questions like, were you really quoting the outlaw Josie Wales in one of your columns? Yes, I was. And listen to Granny Hawkins when she talks about doodly squat. and other things. So I put it out on Facebook. We'll take your questions. And guess what? Under the picture of Edward Hopper, the Nighthawk,
right.
Jeff Carlin just printed out some. And I'm going to ask Jeff one from Ray Flores, who's the first man on the board. Ray Flores asked Jeff asked the Chicago Way, what is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life is to be happy and to respect yourself.
Is that, or is it to ride on the steps, a horse under you, a falcon at your wrist, the wind in your hair? Or is it to drive your enemies before you, to hear the lamentations of their women? Is that what's best in life? I don't think so.
No.
That's just quoting from Conan the Barbarian.
Right.
I don't know what the meaning of life is, but here's the thing. Every day I ask it. Every day we try to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, that's one thing I like about doing this podcast. It's like open the antennas up a little bit. Right? And every day we're asking. Okay, so here's another one, Jeff. Let's see. Paul Sarnecki. What is, was the city most beautiful to either of you, either seasonally or decade?
Oh, that's a good question.
City of Chicago, homeland of my birth.
Good
what
answer.
What would you say? When is it the most beautiful? When was it the most beautiful?
Well, if speaking of Chicago, I say Chicago is most beautiful in early summer, when it's just the right temperature, but you get a good midday heat, and it's not that overbearing humidity that falls into late July and August. But everybody is kind of shaking off their winter shells, and everybody is in a good mood. You know, the weather turns in June, early June, and it's, or late May, but not this year for some reason. Thank you, Al Gore.
Yeah, right.
I think that's the best, because every Chicagoan is in a good mood. You know, people are smiling, and you could just get a high on the street for no reason.
It is down here, especially, right?
Mm-hmm. And especially where I work, the WGN radio and the Allstate studio, ding.
And looking out the glass at all the, including the guy who's doing something that he should be thrown away in jail for on the other side of the patio.
Right.
Right. Which you guys never mentioned, those people.
No, we try not to. But the city comes to life when the weather changes, and it's a lot of fun. And that's probably, when Chicago is the best. But my favorite city?
Yeah.
That's a tough one. I haven't.
My favorite city is Chicago, man.
Well, my favorite city is Chicago.
I'm not, this is Chicago. Wait, you can't, it's illegal to say another city.
Right. But if I'm excluding Chicago, because that's the second favorite. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I haven't traveled enough of the world to see, but I'd say probably Prague was one of my favorites so far.
I have not been to Prague. I've been to other towns, Lagos, Nigeria, Istanbul, Athens, various other places, Georgetown, Guyana. I cannot think of about New York, Los Angeles, et cetera, Denver. Sorry about the pothead crack, people of Denver. I love Denver. I even ate sushi in Denver. That's how much I trust you. I know people are upset. Like, why? What'd you rip
out? Real sushi or Rocky Mountain oysters?
No, I had real sushi in Denver, like a psycho. Here's the beautiful city, Chicago. I'm sitting on the porch of a two-flat. I'm not even sitting on the porch. I'm sitting on the steps. It's March, late March, early April. There's still patches of snow in the cinder alleys where there's perpetual shade. I'm having a smoke, and I'm looking out at the little tiny little yards with the blue Virgin Marys in them. And I look, and there's like maybe an iris or a lily, something starting to grow. And you can kind of smell the old city, that March watery, frozen, icy, slushy smell of earth coming up. And you see kids trying to, bounce basketballs, but there's puddles,
mm-hmm.
but they still want to be outside. And you start smelling like, a good hot dog, or somebody opens a window and starts yelling Jeffrey Carlin, will you please come home? And that to me is just a beautiful thing. That's my word picture, but that's a Chicago I love. Okay, can we take another question or do we have time? All right, let's see. From Philip Dorr, how long before Chicago CPS in Illinois will have to file bankruptcy? And can Rahm, Madigan, and Cullerton survive this happening politically? That's too bad our spiritual sister,
right,
Statehouse chick Christian McQuarrie, isn't here. She would tell us that the city cannot, schools cannot seek bankruptcy unless they get permission.
Right. Unless we change the state constitution.
So why don't we not have bankruptcy, Jeff, and just keep borrowing money?
Because it's the golden parachute for all the knuckleheads in charge that they can, well, hey, we can't do that, so we got to keep doing what we do.
We borrow money to pay our debts, and we're borrowing more. The other day, it was, right, Rahm borrowing another $500 million.
Payday loan, as it was jokingly called, right? Because the interest rate on it is obscene because our state has very little to show for our billions of dollars in loans.
And that's the key, right? And that's what I don't hear or read about. And I write four columns a week and do this podcast, and Jeff Carlin is producing that Rokon show every day. We don't have time to do investigative reporting. But you know what? I'd love to know, if I had the time, which I don't, who's going to make the money on that? Yeah. Who's making the difference? You know, because when the bonds are junk, the interest rate is super sky high. Mm-hmm. It's almost like in the old days, going to, you know, Ohio and Damon and asking for a loan. Or like go to that florist in Chinatown, right on the edge. You know the one. Yeah, Ray, how you doing? And you ask that guy for a loan. And then the two boys, you know, the brothers come and see you. And they're not the brothers. They're actually two brothers.
Right.
Who come to see you. And all that stuff. You don't want to get in that. But it's almost that kind of extortion. So who's making the money?
Not us.
Not us. Jeff Carlin. Is there any more other questions that I missed?
Oh, we got a lot of good questions.
Okay.
Some of them we kind of covered in the first part when we were talking about the D.C. politics of life.
Why is Rahm so ineffective? He's all talk, asked Carolyn Zaha. And Stanford Slansky, my liberal, he's like the guy with the liberal suppository. He's always offering the corrective. You could say that about most politicians.
I will say, there's my answer to why Rahm Emanuel is, quote, ineffective. He's only ineffective to the rest of us, to his friends and the ruling elite. He's very effectual. He makes them very powerful and very wealthy through lots of things that happen in the city. There are lots of people who are making money in Chicago off
the debt and the pay and the pain that the rest of us are going to face.
So the definition of effective is the point here.
Is that fair to Rahm, who as you read this, as you listen to this, I'll probably be, you know, having lunch with him while you're listening. But is that fair? I know, don't say Cass, you're kissing Rahm's ass because, you know, I'm the guy who got jabbed in the chest. He didn't body slam me, but he jabbed me in the chest with the Arby
poke.
Got the Arby poke right in the chest. And then I'm like, really?
No, you're right.
I don't work for the Guardian, man. You put your hands down and we're going to have problems.
That was going to be my first point, but I figured John would get there.
What?
But that the system has been in place long before Rahm, and I would assume it'll be in place long after him unless we do declare bankruptcy.
No money.
Right.
The difference between Rahm and the other mayors is there's no money. Mm-hmm. And what happens? Okay, yeah, get all you haters out there, start hating on me. But here's the deal. We're spending money we don't have. And if you take all the rich people and boil them, and I mean make a good, like a demi-glace, so you'd have to boil, simmer them for 24 hours and then reduce it, there's still not enough money out of their bones. So why do we have so much money? Because we have poor people, okay? That's one reason. And we have social service and cops and firemen. Why do we have all this? Because the Democrats lower the threshold for social programs like Medicaid, et cetera, Medicare, to get people here who vote for them. And then the middle class that has helped subsidize it, along with state and federal, when the money runs out, who gets hurt? The poor who, depending on the services, and the middle class. And what's the difference? The poor can't move.
Right.
But what are the middle class doing? They're going.
Going so, yep.
And what did this system do? It perpetuated power because we had a one-party system, and if they were all Republicans, it could have been the same type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we had all Democrats. So it's a one-party system. They get the money. They leverage the politics for their own personal gain. They end up like, oh, I just happened to make, yeah, I stepped out of politics for 2 minutes, and I happened to make $16 million in the deal with Rauner and Billy Daly. How did that happen? Oh, I don't know. I'm just lucky. I'm just smart. I'm just smarter than you. Or whatever the deal is. And they do this. And who leaves? Jeff Garland. Have you done any Shrink in Chicago on the Rokan show?
Yep.
What are people saying?
Well, yeah, everybody sees it, and it's not a question of, you know, why. It's a question of when people will leave, because people see it. They're, you know, it becomes no longer tenable to be in this city because the property rates, taxes keep going up, the services keep going up, but the actual quality of the services keep going down. I mean, in my area, the area I live, which is kind of Andersonville area, just north of Foster. And this is just a small little piece, but I have done over the last two summers, and this is just an anecdote, so I'll take it with a grain of salt, but there's street cleaning, and there's a schedule, and they say street cleaning is going to be, you know, every street's going to get cleaned hopefully once a month or every five weeks, give or take. Our street, busy street, we go 8, 9, 10 weeks without having a street cleaner on our street. But the street of the alderman who lives on the other side, you know, not only 5, 6 blocks away from us, every 3 weeks, his street is, the signs go up.
What alderman?
The alderman for Andersonville. I don't want to throw the name on there because I, you know, that's.
You like it?
I'm just alleging something that I have very little proof
for. Okay, all right.
So signs go up and they get street cleaning on the regular twice last month, already twice this month. And in that same time, our street's been cleaned once, and the surrounding streets have been cleaned once. And for whatever reason, that street that alderman lives on gets clean at least once a month, if not twice a month.
Same with snow. So in other words, the corruption begins on the most local level, where you, in order to get the best services, you have to cleave to the power guy.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
This is how crooked Chicago is.
Yep.
And that is a crooked thing.
And that's when my people start leaving, because they can deal with that as long as they're not paying through the nose for the street cleaning and through the nose for the water or through the nose for their garbage collection and all these other things.
Or if some homeless guy, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend any homeless guys, but, you know, starts a fire or runs up to your wife and says, can I ask you something? You don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want urban hassle, right? But here's the issue. What about the suburban hassle? Because what's going to happen as the city implodes?
We're a tumor.
Are the suburbs going to be annexed against your will? I mean, what is the outcome here? And then property taxes in the suburbs are going up too. But not everyone could be J.B. Pritzker to have, you know, your million-dollar mansion next to your other million-dollar mansion condemned so that you
Because you took the toilets out.
Because you took the toilets out, so therefore no one can live there. And then you get a deal with Joe Berrios, who's helping you run for governor. How does that work, baby? If that's not J.B. Pritzker, if that's not the Chicago way, Jeff Carlin and I don't know what the Chicago way is. And you're welcome to come on this broadcast anytime to talk to me about why it isn't the Chicago way. Thank you, Elizabeth Taylor. Thank you, Jeff Carlin. Thank you all the people on Facebook like Ray Flores, who asked what is the meaning of life. And Lamar Schlebach, who said, will the Trump presidency survive? Sorry, didn't answer that, but you'll have to read it in the paper. Thanks, Rahm Emanuel, because we're going to have lunch, and you'll probably jab me with the RB in my chest if you don't like the questions. And also, thank the Chicago Fire. 4 wins in a row. Everybody happy out there at Toyota Park? Betty asked, can we take the boys and all of us together to the Fire, and let's hope they win? And they did. Jeff Carlin liked it. Tweet, which is awesome. So thank you, Chicago Fire, and thank everybody else for listening. This has been another edition of the Chicago Week, and we'll talk to you next week.